Blog Talk Radio.
The sun go down and lulls us to our sleep. Beloved, who makes the earth so round about the sun to sleep? Mother, who speaks her words in the silent moonlit night above.
Cosmic Citizen. Saturday morning, beautiful day here in Colorado. Looks like it might rain again, but of course in this state we love the rain. So I'm your host, Paula Thompson, and with me is my good friend and good longtime friend and co-host, Andre Rodatis. Hi, Andre. Andre, are you there?
I am here. I thought I'd hit that, you know, mute button, and by goodness, I hadn't.
Well, I could see you on the you know, the list of callers, so I knew you were with us.
Yeah.
You know, Crystalline hasn't been able to make it the last couple of weeks, and some may know Crystalline has a condition that. In her neck, and that creates migraine headaches and different situations, and she's been suffering with that a lot lately. So, you know, your prayers, this show is all about prayers and the efficacy of prayers and the beauty of prayers and the power of prayers. So if you want to send some prayers up for Crystalline, that would be awesome. Our dear friend who would love to be on the show. She enjoys doing the show, and we know she'd be here if she could, and she may call in, and we hope she does. So, but send some prayers up. And, you know, we wanted to do this show on prayer. We just finished our show on life after death, and it was wonderful, well received. Got a lot of great emails from you guys about it. You really appreciated it and enjoyed it, and we're so glad. We love doing it. That's why we do it. You know, the Urantia book is an amazing book, and it says so much about so many things. It is so rich, so diverse, so replete, so internally consistent. It claims to be a revelation, and gee, if it's not a revelation, please show me one, because I've never seen anything better.
Well, and, you know, call us wandering fools or call us believers. But, you know, bottom line is, bought it hook, line, sinker. Made it easy to us. And we've just been loving it for years and years and years. And if you're just new to the revelation, if you're just tuning in to the Cosmic Citizen for the first time, You can find that at a number of different sites, truthbook.org and, you know, urantia.org and ubfellowship.org and
urantiabook.org.
Urantiabook.org. I mean, you don't have to buy the book. Nobody's trying to sell you a book. Just read it, take a look at it, see if it speaks to you. You know, we've got a world that definitely needs the truth that book has in it. And, you know, there's a lot of wonderful things that you can study in that book, but its main message is that because God is our loving Father, all men and women are brothers and sisters on this planet. And how about a big amen to that?
Amen. Amen to that. And, you know, I want to reiterate what you said, Andre. You know, we're just making it available. I think that's, you know, I feel like personally that's my job. You know, the Urantia book says that Jesus had a simple invitation, and always his invitation was, whosoever will, let him come. Whosoever will, let him come. And I feel like, you know, there are people who are searching, just like I was searching, like you were searching for another, more meaning and value in religious information, searching for more freedom to decide and choose for themselves, searching for something that makes more sense to them, searching for a God that they really want to believe in, you know, not a punishing God, an angry God, a vengeful God, but a kind, loving, merciful, tolerant, patient, perfect God. And that's what the Urantia book holds up. And so, you know, and so we're going to read, you know, this paper. It's from the middle part of the book, The History of Urantia, which is just another way of saying the history of Earth. And it's called The Evolution of Prayer. And it's such an insightful paper. Like so many of these papers right here together in this section, kind of show us how we have come to be where we are and who we are. Mm-hmm. And show us how primitive humans deal with certain things. The paper just before this paper is called Medicine Men, you know, Shamanism, Medicine Men and Priests. The one before that, paper 89, Sin, Sacrifice and Atonement. 88, paper 88, Fetishes, Charms and Magic. 87, yeah. The Ghost Cults. You know, so they've taken us on a progression here from what primitive and humans think. And they're trying to lead us into a place of an age of science and enlightenment and a new way of thinking about God and a new way of thinking about all of these issues that we've dealt with, these issues of the spirit, these problems of spiritual existence. And if you're a scientist and you're you know, just completely into the material realms and you deny the existence of spirit, then this book is probably not for you. Although, you know, I would say give it a shot.
Give it a shot, you know.
Yeah.
As Terry Kruger said so many years ago, put it on a T-shirt. You got to read it to believe it.
Yeah,
you know?
You have to. Yeah. Entertain the
really,
idea.
It's really that kind of a book. If you never give it a chance, like so many things in life, it's not going to speak to you. But if you give it a chance, if you just try and let it speak to you and do as I did, look for internal inconsistencies, because, you know, I didn't want to be duped or anything like that. I didn't, you know, I just avoided, before finding this, I just avoided a mind cult and a material cult. And, you know, I was looking for something genuine. But speaking of prayer, you know, one thing about prayer is be careful what you ask for, because here I was. I remember coming out of catechism when I was 6 years old, and It was Our Lady of Lourdes School in Waterloo, Ontario. And at Our Lady of Lourdes, you know, they were teaching catechism in first grade and making sure that we were going to grow up to be good Catholics. And I really appreciated what I was learning. And I remember them teaching and saying, you know, what we had just come up to Jesus in the temple when he was 12, you know, and having sort of gotten lost and away from Mary and Joseph in the temple. Well, he wasn't lost, but they thought they'd lost him. And talking to the scribes and Pharisees and impressing them quite a bit. And then all of a sudden, and so yeah, and then the next thing is he's 30 years old.
Yeah.
Said, what? What?
Yeah. Where did the...
And I, you know, I said to my teacher, who was Sister Norbert, Sister Norbert, you know, how come we don't know anything about those 18 years, you know, for Jesus from age 12 to age 3? Oh, well, that's the private life of Jesus. No, it was the response to me. And, you know, already at that age, I was a little credulous, and or maybe not. I bought it. I said, okay. It's okay, the private life of Jesus. So somehow that stuck in my head, and I can only imagine that my thought adjuster had seized on that phrase and was just whacking the side of the wall of my brain with it, you know, and just, you know, the private life of Jesus. And as I walked by the church that was, just, you know, paired with the school, Our Lady of Lourdes, I looked up at the church and I remember distinctly praying and saying, God, if there's any way for me to know about the private life of Jesus, teach me.
Oh.
And my God, do you know how beautiful God is? Is that it just took 11 years. It just took 11 years more. Can you believe that? Can you believe how efficient that prayer was answered?
Well, I had a similar one when I was 16, when I had rejected a fundamental religion, and one that had told me that if I wasn't able to convert my parents to this religion, they would die at Armageddon and it would be my fault. And I totally rejected that. And I walked out. I'll never forget. I stood on the steps of this woman's house who was teaching me this. And I said, I'm sorry, I can't accept that, and I can't be involved with you guys anymore. And she was just stunned by that pronouncement. But I stood on the steps of her house, and I looked up, and I said to God, you know, God, you may be just the way they say you are. And if you are, I'm sorry, but I can't worship you. And then as an afterthought, I thought, you know, somehow, God, I don't think you are that way. But you are going to have to reveal yourself to me, because I'm not getting involved with any more religions.
Yeah.
And look at how he revealed himself to me.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah. Well, we have a caller who wants to join us in this call, and he just dropped off. I'm not sure why, but Sean from England, oh, here he is. He'd like to read with us today, Andre, so won't that be
Excellent. Wonderful?
Oh,
marvelous. Let's bring him on, and let's have him read the first part.
Yeah, Sean, we're so happy to have you on the call with us all the way from England and willing to read with us. And welcome,
Sean. Good morning,
Sean.
Mate.
Good morning.
Hi, Matt. How are you doing?
Good. Good to have you on.
Hey, listen, thanks for letting me come on. The thing is, my children are playing in the house. And making a lot of noise. If they come diving into the room making a lot of noise, I'll have to sort of mute myself out.
Okay.
Other than that, I'm looking forward to reading.
Okay, good.
Excellent.
And your call is breaking up just a little bit. I'm not sure why, but maybe there's a... on the optimum.
Shall I make a sound and you can just shout out if you want me to stop. Oh, so we're on page 91, is that right?
We're on paper 91, and it might be a little. Why don't we try it for a paragraph? Because you are breaking up. Are you on a cell?
No, I'm actually on Skype. Shall I call back?
Try calling back, yeah, and see if we can get a better
connection.
See if
we get a better line. Yeah. Okay.
Okay.
Well, that's
so
wonderful.
It'll be fun.
Yeah.
I'm thrilled, and I want to open it up to anybody. Look, you know, friends, if you've had a prayer that you feel like very clearly was answered, call in and share it with us. We're talking about prayer for the next couple of weeks, 2 or 3 weeks. We're going to be talking about prayer, and we'd love to hear about your prayers answered. We'd love to hear about how you feel the Urantia Book answered your prayers, or whatever you have found has answered your prayers. So our call-in number is 646-716-8158. And if like Sean, you want to call in and read with us, well, we love that. We'd love to have you call in. So
yeah, we're all brothers and sisters all over this planet.
Yep, that's the lesson we have to learn, isn't it? That we treat each other
just
with
one of the lessons.
Yeah, that's a big one. That's a big one.
Yeah.
So, Sean, you're back with us.
How's this?
Can you hear me okay now, guys?
Much better. Much better.
Much better. Okay. Yeah, you're not breaking up as much.
Okay.
Yeah.
Shall I start then on the beginning of paper 91?
Yes, please. Paper 91.
Okay. How many? What do you want me to do? Just the first section. What is that?
Let's do the first section, the introductory section, and then let's discuss it.
Okay.
And you know, let me just say, this is just a thrill. It really is. If it's important for you, Sean, it's important for us too. You know, it's just this wonderful connection that we have all over the planet. And you know, the idea that we can study this book and bridge the gap. I mean, it's only a little pond between us, but still, you know, we get to talk across the pond.
It'd be great. You know, the more people from around the world that can call in, the better. I think. I mean, I love listening to what you guys, you know, talk about. I think you're in Canada, aren't you, Andre? But in North America. That's great. But
I was in Canada. I'm back in Boulder, Colorado, living here again.
Okay.
But I was in Quebec in the region of Saint-Faustin-Lac-Carré near Mont-Tremblant. And, you know, it's wherever we are, we can be connected. That's just an amazing part of our 21st century life here.
I mean, without going off on a tangent. A few months ago, I got involved briefly in a Skype study group for the Urantia Book, and at one point I was on there. There was somebody in the States, there was somebody in Japan, and then there was a lady in India.
Isn't there? I love that.
It was great fun. Anyway, I'll make a start. So we're on paper 91, The Evolution of Prayer. Prayer, as an agency of religion, evolved from previous non-religious monologue and dialogue expressions. With the attainment of self-consciousness by primitive man, there occurred the inevitable corollary of other consciousness, the dual potential of social response and God recognition. The earliest prayer forms were not addressed to deity. These expressions were much like what you would say to a friend as you entered upon some important undertaking. Wish me luck. Primitive man was enslaved to magic. Luck, good and bad, entered into all the affairs of life. At first, these luck petitions were monologues, just a kind of thinking out loud by the magic server. Next, these believers in luck would enlist the support of their friends and families, and presently some form of ceremony would be performed which included the whole clan or tribe. When the concepts of ghosts and spirits evolved, these petitions became superhuman in address, and with the consciousness of gods, such expressions attained to the levels of genuine prayer.
As an illustration of this, among certain Australian tribes, primitive religious prayers antedated their belief in spirits and superhuman personalities. The Toda tribe of India now observes this practice of praying to no one in particular, just as did the early peoples before the times of religious consciousness. Only among the Todas, this represents a regression of their degenerating religion to its primitive level. The present-day rituals of the dairymen priests of the Todas do not represent a religious ceremony, since these impersonal prayers do not contribute anything to the conservation or enhancement of any social, moral, or spiritual values. Pre-religious praying was part of the manner practices of the Melanesians, the Uda beliefs of the African Pygmies, and the Manitou superstitions of the North American Indians. The Baganda tribes of Africa have only recently emerged from the manna level of prayer. In this early evolutionary confusion, men pray to gods, local and national, to fetishes, amulets, ghosts, rulers, and to ordinary people.
So, you know, one thing that strikes me about that section is, you know, they're giving us very specific examples of primitive forms of prayer. And interestingly, fetishes, amulets, you know, totems, magic, essentially, like there's some mojo that if I did it just right,
right,
this specific mojo, whatever it is, you know, this totem, this amulet, this combination of different medicines, this wish for luck, if I appeal to the gods just right, then I'll win their favor, and my life somehow will be easier. You know, to me, that seems to be the overarching concept, is somehow to make my life easier by appeasing these gods. And we know, you know, sacrifice looms large in this. They haven't said it yet, but sacrifice, and this idea of sacrificing was another way of appealing to the gods.
Right, and the idea of you know, life was hard. There had to be a reason that life was hard. Life was hard because we were doing something wrong, is, you know, what we came up with. And, you know, these wonderful papers and the papers that you mentioned ahead of this, you know, all of this was captured right around the turn of the last century by what were known as people that were, you know, studying the science of society. They were calling it before it really became sociology, and the leaders in this were Herbert Spencer along with William Graham Sumner and his protege Albert Galloway Keller, and a lot of what we have here is both distillation of a lot of the thinking that was going on at that time, plus filling in the gaps that they couldn't possibly have known. But the data that was collected on this was just amazing, and the reason we have as much as we have on this is because, is almost single-handedly because we humans had made effort in this area, even though it wasn't well known, even though sociology took a decided less scientific kind of bent or a softer scientific kind of bent. There were these ideas of promulgating laws of social evolution, which was a brand new thought in humankind. Well, you can see that it's been an important thought because it's captured here in the Urantia book. And part of what they're trying to let us know is that not only do we evolve as a species and as individuals, but all of our institutions evolve, including prayer. We start out where we are. We start with this impulse to pray and with ideas to pray about things that make no sense whatsoever. And the context in which to look at all of this, taking it away from the sociology for a minute, is that makes perfect sense that we would do this kind of thing, and that it would be okay to God. You know, it wouldn't be okay from our standpoint because we're trying to sway deity. We're trying to get God to do what we want God to do. But since we didn't understand at a primitive level that God was not going to be swayed exactly by our prayers, that's how we prayed. Still, what we're going to see in this paper is just how, through literally hundreds of thousands of years, prayer has evolved, and how much of that evolution has been as a result of revelation over just the last few thousand years. And we find ourselves in the place today where we have all of these levels of prayer still available on the planet, where this very, very primitive prayer is being practiced by, I don't want to say a majority of people, but let's say a large, large minority of people, and all the way up to some people who clearly had a conversational and a true appraisal of a loving God. And we, of course, you know, Jesus is the first one to come up. But even not looking at a God-man, even not looking at a Son of God incarnated, you can look at people like Peace Pilgrim, and you can look at, as a modern-day example, or Moses, John the Baptist, any number of people all the way along, Baha'u'llah, you know, for the Baha'is, and Guru Nanak for the Sikhs, you know, on and on.
Mm. So true. Sean, do you have any thoughts on this?
Yeah, just one thing that just came into my head while Andre was talking was the notion that primitive beliefs, you know, are easy for people to manipulate. So, you know, you kind of wonder how much of our, you know, the religious history of human beings has been influenced by people who just thought, well, we can manipulate uneducated people into thinking that if they have the right amulets, and we can sell them the amulets, that that their crops will grow or their children will be healthy or whatever it might be. So I just wonder how much of that, how much people have been, you know, manipulated. Particularly, I'm going to say people in primitive cultures, but maybe in also some modern cultures.
Well, I think they've been. I mean, what immediately comes to mind is the example of the money changers, and this idea that you can't make your offering in the currency of your
yes.
Choice. But you have to have it changed into the temple currency,
yeah.
and thereby pay the fee to the money changers.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it's just the it goes on and on, doesn't it? Ways for us to exploit the superstition in our fellows or the religious, their ignorance about God, and to create this belief in shamanism, or only those few who have the real story and the rest of us aren't worthy, and so they have to interpret it for us.
But I think we're all vulnerable to it to an extent.
Oh, we are.
I can remember a few years ago we were on holiday in Italy, and I can't remember where we were exactly, but we were just walking through a little street. I think we were in a place called Sorrento in Italy, and somebody was selling...
Oh, I've been there.
Yeah, it's absolutely beautiful. I think I can't remember what it was. Somebody was selling like crosses, because obviously Italy, it's a Catholic country, and somebody was taking advantage of that and selling crosses or something. And I can't remember the exact circumstances, but I felt like if I didn't buy this, I'd be struck down with bad luck.
It's a seduction.
And
it's a very
sophisticated. It's not real, but you don't want to take the chance anyway.
Well, exactly, and that's what it's that ghost fear that is talked about as one of the drives. I mean, there were the three main drives, hunger, sex, vanity, which led to the institutions of self-maintenance, self-perpetuation, and self-gratification, which allowed us to have all kinds of the institutions of the home and marriage and various other kinds of institutions. But the other one, the one that came out of the inner life of man, was ghost fear. And, this is again, a tremendous revelation in the Urantia book. Not because we hadn't discovered that, on our own, but largely because we've been losing sight of that in how much of that has carried over into modern life. That essentially a lot of these ideas we've had from primitive times have been perpetuated. When you think about your youth and you think about just little games that you played, like, I remember playing hopscotch, with the kids in the neighborhood, and don't step on a crack or you'll break your mother's back, that kind of thing.
I still think that when I'm taking a walk. I still think that.
Right. There's those kinds of silly, crazy things that get perpetuated not only by the adults, but just by the kids passing it on to other kids. And so those kinds of things that are passed on before we hit the age of reason, where our reason begins to flourish at about age 12, or at least is incepted, tend to get stuck in there. So, people talking about bad luck and the number 13, creates triskaidekaphobia, literal fear. We have a word for the fear of the number 13, okay, in the English language. And, so that's just remarkable that so much carries forward, and you literally have to almost force yourself to put those kinds of notions aside. But I have to admit, I probably still don't walk under ladders.
we're fighting a couple of million years of genetic memory. I don't know if that's probably not a scientific term, but I think you understand what I mean by that. So
yeah.
We can
yeah.
rationally say now that these, walking on the ladder doesn't bring bad luck, but we'll still step around that ladder.
Right.
Can I just say something else? It's just I'm just looking again at
sure.
that text I've read, and it's just interesting because it says that the earliest prayer forms were not addressed to deities. It says these expressions are much like what you say to a friend, along the lines of wish me luck. So it's just interesting that this is some kind of base programming that's wired into us, and it was, before we had any notion of God. So this notion of luck, it's interesting that the book makes a link between those primitive those thought patterns and them eventually developing into prayer.
Well, yeah, and what you have to be struck by the fact that this is pervasive today in an age of science and enlightenment.
Mm-hmm.
That look at any sports team.
Sure.
And this belief that if I don't wear my lucky shirt,
mm-hmm.
or if I don't, and some of the sports, the highly played players or paid players, they fall into it more than anything. I mean, they go through these elaborate rituals on game day, and it's this very thing. It's this belief that if you do it just right, that.
Yes.
You know,
well, it's gotten to the point in hockey, for instance, that you know, hockey players, when it comes to the playoffs, it may not be the rest of the season, but during the playoffs, everybody grows a beard. You know, it's you know, because wins have been associated with when they had beards. Nobody doesn't not grow a beard just in case. You know, mm-hmm. that kind of thing. You know, and so there's all kinds of those.
Well, and how many times do you see someone spill salt and throw a little over their shoulder, you know? Or, like I said, I still think when I'm out taking a walk, I still hear the old childhood adage, you step on a crack, you break your mother's back. And, of course,
yeah.
my mother isn't even living anymore, but I still...
Yeah, there's no chance of breaking her back now. So maybe you need to just stomp on a few cracks just for good measure, Paula, as you as you go walking down the road and just, you know.
But if you do that, Paula, make sure you don't stomp on 13 cracks because that would be bad.
Yeah, that would be bad. Yeah. And you know, I almost, just what you said, I defiantly step on the crack at that moment that I have that thought because I think, take that, superstition. You know, it's funny how pervasive it is. You know how you can insinuate something that is just a superstition, and how much power we humans will give that.
Mm-hmm.
You know this, and we, even more so than when you say something like, "Well, if you believe that, you're going to hell." You know,
right. And that too is literally a superstition because, you know, we don't have, there's very little that's even biblically, you know, talked about that, situated by the oral tradition,
right.
More than anything else, and by preachment, by everything else, that it's not necessarily that you can find that kind of thing in the Bible. But this brings to me another pernicious, the other side of this, which is how many individuals, you know, around the world, and it's certainly we have the atheistic and the secularist kind of issues in America, but the fact that there is so much superstition and that it's associated with organized religion, but religious behavior or spiritualist behavior. And I don't really mean to say spiritualist. I mean more generally spiritual predilection, you know, on the part of people.
Mm-hmm.
If you say anything about spirituality in Europe today, you are literally almost laughed at, aren't you, Sean?
Yeah, I think I've mentioned this when I previously called in, but a couple of friends of mine, I'm in my late 40s, but a couple of my friends are quite a lot younger than me, and a couple of times I've made the mistake of you know, intimating that I have faith, you know, for want of a better word, and they sort of look at me, and they look at me with horror, absolute horror. They just can't get, they can't grasp it. They just think I'm crazy. They think that my IQ has been cut in half as soon as I mention anything to do with, you know, religious beliefs or spiritual beliefs.
Right, and you know, my words of solace to all you know, spiritual believers, you know, whether Urantian or of any other stripe in Europe, is not so much stand by your guns, but you know, feel the confidence from inside. You know, as
mm-hmm.
as you realize your own religious life, this ridicule is pernicious, and this idea of spirituality being unsophisticated is a pernicious idea. And unfortunately, in Europe, it does sway a lot of people who just would not want to be caught, you know, dead, you know, being found out to be religious in any way. And I think the thing that may eventually sway some people. Clearly, some people will never be swayed. But the fact that, that some people may be able to argue points, and the Urantia book gives plenty of talking points regarding the validity of spirituality, but more than anything, because it validates the inner life, I think we can talk from our own personal spiritual experience. And, you know, it may be hard and it may be uncomfortable at first to do that, just because anything you do that you haven't done very often or you haven't done at all is a little bit difficult. But as one gets to be a little more used to that, at some point, people begin to see that there's a track record with you. They begin to say, "You mean you still read that thing? You know, it's 20 years later, you're still reading that."
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
That's pretty remarkable. Or, "You mean you still believe in God?" Mm-hmm. You know, after, and especially when they see that you're intelligent in every other area of your life, it becomes a point of, you can make the point that people have an unreasoned prejudice if they say, "Really, you think I'm just being unintelligent in this realm of my life? You see that I'm competent in these other areas, so why would you jump to that conclusion?"
It's also what I also notice is often the people who are what I call devout atheists often what they'll often do, that they'll find no contradiction in criticizing anybody that has any sort of spiritual beliefs or spiritual, faith. They won't find any contradiction between that and then the fact that, for example, that they use excessive amounts of alcohol to get through the week. And I think to myself, how's your devout atheism working for you? Why is it you drink so much? Is that, I find that interesting.
Mm-hmm. And isn't it ironic that they're actually replacing the spirit for spirits that are, contrived, man-made. They're using a poor substitute to replace the real thing. And I have to jump in with a quote from Paper 4, which is, I'm sure I've read this on the air before. It's one of my favorites, but it really shows kind of the situation we're in. It says, "The barbarous idea of appeasing an angry God, of propitiating an offended Lord, of winning the favor of deity through sacrifices and penance, and even by the shedding of blood, represents a religion wholly puerile and primitive, a philosophy unworthy of an enlightened age of science and truth. Such beliefs are utterly repulsive to the celestial beings and the divine rulers who serve and reign in the universes. It is an affront to God to believe, hold, or teach that innocent blood must be shed in order to win his favor or to divert his fictitious divine wrath." And the other side of that quote is then, there are many now who have wholly embraced science, completely embraced it. And with that embracing of science in this age of science, which it's true, we are in an age of science, and science has solved many problems for us, and bravo for us. We've thrown God out with the bathwater. We've thrown, God is, if you start to look at the triads in the Urantia book and the balance of all that is, thought, meaning, value, truth, beauty, goodness, father, mother, child, you can go on and on, thought, word, deed, science, religion, philosophy. It's three, and that creates balance. That's holistic, body, mind, spirit. You are a whole being. You're not just a body. You're not just a mind. You're a spirit. You're all three. And when we throw out one whole third of reality, everything is skewed then. Nothing makes sense then. And that's why people turn to contrived relief like alcohol, because they can't make sense of their existence. They've thrown out a whole full third of their reality, and even more, really, because the spirit reality encompasses all of it. It's like the Urantia book tells us that God is omnipresent, omnipotent, and omniscient, omniscient, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we have all three, and we think that he's either, one or the other. No. And until you really reach out through prayer, which is what we're talking about here, to the inner life, the reality of God, and you reach out with faith and say, God, like you did, Andre, show me the private life of Jesus. And I did. God, reveal yourself to me. And watch what happens. Jesus said, watch and pray.
Well, I've advocated for a long time now, and I've done this in Toastmaster groups from time to time, when I've been doing a speech or, on spirituality or the value of love or as prayer has come up, and, I say, I don't expect people, to just accept the idea that spirituality is real, but if you were really being fair about it, what you would do is you would engage in an experiment the way you would scientifically. So why not do a 21-day prayer project where you just take 5 minutes, take 5 minutes to pray to no one in particular or to what you conceive to be God or however you want to do it.
Or the universe, just, or...
Yeah, try that for 21 days. See what happens in your life.
Yeah.
And I don't know that there's a guarantee that something will happen, but what I think would happen, given the fact that we do have thought adjusters, is that there will be something unmistakable in terms of some change in that person's mm-hmm. life. There will be something that changes in the inside or the outside or in the mind or in the heart or in life outside. There will be something that changes that gets your attention either a little or a lot. And there'll be, it will not be coercive. It will only be at the level of if you are willing, it will mean something. And if you're not willing, it will be perhaps easy to dismiss. But the fact of the matter is something will happen. And so I advocate that people will do that. I don't have any data to back up what I'm saying, but I do have a clear sense that you cannot reach out to the universe, to reach out to God, and not have there be some kind of response that will get your attention, especially if you're sincere in wanting to know.
Sincerely open to the response that will come.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And even if you're cynical about it, if you're just willing to take the action, that faith action, that makes a difference. Faith is real. In the believer, in the unbeliever, it doesn't matter. In the faither, in the person without faith, it doesn't matter. It's one of the three cosmic intuitions, and it makes a difference if you use it versus not using it. As soon as you use it, you have engaged in something that is very real in reality. As real as reason is to science and logic is to philosophy, faith is to personal spiritual experience. And you will know something in your inner life that you can either choose to ignore or choose to embrace and see where the next step leads.
And Andre, you mentioned the three cosmic intuitions, and they are the correlation of a factual science, a moral philosophy, and a genuine religious experience. These are the three cosmic intuitions.
Yeah.
And that's the blended, the wholeness that we were talking about before. So let's keep going with this paper. I can read number one, Primitive Prayer.
Do it.
We're in paper 91 from the Urantia book. You're listening to Blog Talk Radio and the Cosmic Citizen. And this paper is called The Evolution of Prayer. Section number one, Primitive Prayer. The function of early evolutionary religion is to conserve and augment the essential social, moral, and spiritual values which are slowly taking form. This mission of religion is not consciously observed by mankind, but it is chiefly affected by the function of prayer. The practice of prayer represents the unintended but nonetheless personal and collective effort of any group to secure, to actualize, this conservation of higher values. But for the safeguarding of prayer, all holy days would speedily revert to the status of mere holidays. Religion and its agencies, the chief of which is prayer, are allied only with those values which have general social recognition, group approval. Therefore, when primitive man attempted to gratify his baser emotions or to achieve unmitigated selfish ambitions, he was deprived of the consolation of religion and the assistance of prayer. If the individual sought to accomplish anything antisocial, he was obliged to seek the aid of non-religious magic, resort to sorcerers, and thus be deprived of the assistance of prayer. Prayer, therefore, very early became a mighty promoter of social evolution, moral progress, and spiritual attainment. But the primitive mind was neither logical nor consistent. Early men did not perceive that material things were not the province of prayer. These simple-minded souls reasoned that food, shelter, rain, game, and other material goods enhanced the social welfare, and therefore they began to pray for these physical blessings. While this constituted a perversion of prayer, it encouraged the effort to realize these material objectives by social and ethical actions. Such a prostitution of prayer, while debasing the spiritual values of a people, nevertheless directly elevated their economic, social, and ethical mores. Prayer is only monologous in the most primitive type of mind. It early becomes a dialogue and rapidly expands to the level of group worship. Prayer signifies that the pre-magical incantations of primitive religion have evolved to that level where the human mind recognizes the reality of beneficent power or beings who are able to enhance social values and to augment moral ideals, and further, that these influences are superhuman and distinct from the ego of the self-conscious human and his fellow mortals. True prayer does not, therefore, appear until the agency of religious ministry is visualized as personal. Prayer is little associated with animism, but such beliefs may exist alongside emerging religious sentiments. Many times, religion and animism have had entirely separate origins. with those mortals who have not been delivered from the primitive bondage of fear, there is a real danger that all prayer may lead to a morbid sense of sin, unjustified convictions of guilt, real or fancied. But in modern times, it is not likely that many will spend sufficient time at prayer to lead to this harmful brooding over their unworthiness or sinfulness. The dangers attendant upon the distortion and perversion of prayer consist in ignorance, superstition, crystallization, devitalization, materialism, and fanaticism. So they've really said so much there. Are you guys with me still?
Yeah, still here.
Sure are. Yeah, I'm sorry.
I was gonna, am I alone?
only
I'm struck by that primitive bondage of fear line. I think it's really powerful.
Oh, man.
Fear, well, again, fear. They're trying to talk about how things evolve and that we came from very, very primitive beginnings when it comes to prayer. That may not be how people pray today, but many people still do pray with elements of this in their prayer. And, you know, many of us do in many respects. I don't say that praying for somebody who's in ill health is a prayer that's on this level, but in a certain sense, if that's all it is, if what we're praying for is just for their health, as opposed to for their true betterment and their progress in life, and maybe for the growth of wisdom and their growth toward God, then maybe to that extent, that prayer does hearken to this level. You know, there's nothing wrong with that. It just states where we are. And I think there's definitely a mixture in everything we do. And yet at the same time, I'm mightily moved by certain demonstrations. They're not scientific demonstrations, but the fact that when somebody who's very ill is being prayed for, sometimes even if they don't know about it, but very often those people get better. So I don't know what to think about all of that at times. You know, I certainly don't want to lapse into magic. But on the other hand, I do understand that this universe rises to the occasion, not for any kind of simple-minded thing of, okay, they're praying for their healing, let's go ahead and heal them. We weren't going to do that anyway. I don't think it's like that. I do think, though, that when there is that kind of motivation, there's almost like a linking up of people. There's an acknowledgement of the bond, the bonds of fraternity and fellowship, just the bonds of fraternity, the bonds of brotherly and sisterly love that are between us, and that somehow makes a difference. And I wouldn't pretend to know what spiritual laws are behind that, but I can't help but think that there are spiritual laws behind it. Just from having experiences like when you meditate in a group, there is at least a subjective experience of there being something more happening in some of those group meditations and group prayers. And I would be hard-pressed to say what it is, but I trust that there is something real there.
Yeah, there's a collective, almost a collective mind that happens. I've heard it so many times in groups that meditate together that they have a similar vision. And, you know, they come to a similar conclusion at the end of the meditation.
Right.
And, you know, I was struck by this idea that you know, they started to pray for food, shelter, rain, game, and other material goods. Well, obviously that still goes on, you know. I know people in drought-stricken states right now are praying for rain and enhance the social welfare and therefore began to pray for these physical blessings. While this constituted a perversion of prayer, it encouraged the effort to realize these material objectives by social and ethical actions. I find that just so insightful because what we focus on, if we focused on it enough to say it out loud and to pray for it, you know, God, you know, maybe we don't, we can't reason out that what we need to do is say, God, help us to solve these problems. Give us the ability, the wisdom, the strength, the knowledge, you know, the forward momentum, the drive. Help us to achieve our goals, not rather than solve these problems for us, which is often what prayer becomes. Father, solve these problems for us. Because we don't want to solve these problems. We want you to do it. You're so much better at it than we are.
Mm-hmm.
But even then, we're focusing on that problem, and so just by focusing on it, by bringing it to our own attention, we increase our ability to solve it. Go ahead, though, Andre. What were you going to say?
Well, we do, and I agree. I mean, I don't think we can underscore that too much. I think this is, again, something that we're getting a spotlight from the revelation that even if people pray for the wrong things, there is a twofold benefit. One is psychologic, and that is that it will redound to the benefit of perhaps something in the economic or, you know, the outward moral realm or some other realm of sociologic realm. But the other aspect is that it will create, you know, a super psychologic desire to perhaps do better with that thing. You know, so it's not just psychology. There's element of we pray for it. The thought adjuster listens to us. And Sean posted, you know, does the thought adjuster speak to us during prayer? You know, my thought on that is the thought adjuster does speak to us, but we largely hear the thought adjuster superconsciously. Still, that superconscious influence does then make a difference by virtue of us having expressed what we expressed. God, expresses something back to us and expresses that even if we have expressed something that is childish or inappropriate or immature. Like has been pointed out in this section, it's the answer that Jesus gave, you know, to the apostles. You know, if somebody asks for bread, will you give them a stone? If they unwisely ask for a snake, will you give it to a child?
Just because it came up in the net?
Right, exactly. Will a good loving parent, you know, reinterpret that and say, well, what would they really like or what would they really benefit from and perhaps try to give that? And I think that's what the thought adjuster is doing constantly. I think the thought adjuster is able to say, well, I understand what this symbol really means, you know, on an elevated level. And I think we ought to really begin to understand some of those things. It occurred to me very often, like, I mean, we all have the experience of going shopping. And, you know, the shopaholic kind of impulses that are pervasive, especially in American and Canadian society, I doubt that they're somewhat there in European and British society either. Those influences are such that we have been bombarded with so much advertising that links up the purchase of some kind of consumer good with a symbolic, almost emotional, even fine.
Andre, you're breaking up a little bit.
Okay, that could be. I could have hit a dead spot here. Am I better now?
Yeah, okay. Much better. You said that the belief that, you know, purchasing goods, and we didn't hear much after that.
Right, that, you know, that if we purchase some kind of goods, it symbolizes something to us.
Yeah.
You know, it can be, you know, we have the beer commercial that associates that with good times with people, better fellowship, you know, better relationships, better sex, God knows what, you know, that
beautiful
is all associated
women.
With that. Yeah. And I mean, all of those things are symbols. You know, what does relationship with a beautiful woman symbolize? What does relationship mm-hmm. with an Audi symbolize? You know, all of those kinds of things. It when we become a little more conscious of that, we're probably a little less prone to wanting to pray for that. We begin to realize, okay, I'm kind of stuck in the mud there a little bit. What is it that symbol means to me, and what would be the elevated version of that? What's the higher frame in which I could be thinking about that? And, you know, could I ask for better friendships? Could I ask for a better relationship with that neighbor who, you know, keeps letting their dog, you know, go on my lawn or whatever that is, you know? It can be any number of things that are tweaking us.
Yeah.
But
and when we get tweaked, it really is maybe a Rorschach for us to say, okay, what is it about this situation that tweaks me so bad? And how important is it really? You know,
yes.
In the greater scheme of things, how important is it really? And that would be a good prayer. You know, Tony Robbins says, and it's something I really love, and it just always stays with me. He says, you know, what modern men and women need to learn to do is ask a better question. And I think that's really to say a better prayer, you know?
I agree.
Ask a better question, make a better prayer. Because a better question gets a better answer. And so does a better prayer. We have a caller that's been on hold for a while. I'd like to put him on. And Sean, hang on here with us. You're welcome to stay on the whole show if you like. Love your comments.
Will do.
And
will do.
Your input. Area code 720, you're with us on the Cosmic Citizen. 720? Are you
there? Just listening?
Hello?
Hello.
Hello.
Who do we have here?
Oh, this is Joan.
Oh, hi, Joan.
Oh, hi, Joan.
Hi. I thought I would mention that I recently spent some time looking at paper 146, section 2, about when Jesus was answering Nathaniel's questions about prayer. Thanksgiving and worship, and there are about 16 items in that section, and I think they are also very helpful.
We
You're
hope
stealing
to
our
actually
a little bit. Yeah.
And I like this so much. I made kind of a little summary, and I think one of the important things that stood out for me was that the first thing that we should give our attention to in prayer is asking for what is God's will.
Oh.
And then after that, petition for knowledge of the Father's will is most important. And next is the prayer for divine guidance or divine wisdom.
Mm-hmm.
And Jesus encouraged believers to use prayer as a means of leading up through thanksgiving to true worship.
Right.
And the Spirit of the Father speaks best to man when the human mind is in an attitude of true worship. And then this important admonition that I think it's very easy to forget is that Jesus taught that after we have made our prayers to the Father, to remain for a time in silent receptivity to give the indwelling spirit better opportunity to speak to the listening soul.
Mm-hmm. I love that.
Would you believe that this is one of the places we hope to go in the near future is to talk about this very section, Joan?
Yeah.
Oh.
In this...
I got ahead of the plan.
That's okay. We're on the same page.
We're
good to hear your voice and so glad to have you on with, you know, it's good to just have you aboard and making that comment because, you know, we're talking about the evolution of prayer and clearly that's where we're evolving to. That's where we ought to move our thinking to is the idea that prayer is for divine wisdom second, for knowing the Father's will first, and remaining in silent receptivity to, if not hear the Father, which I don't think the vast, vast majority of us do directly, I wouldn't expect to, but certainly maybe get a leading, maybe get an inkling of the next right thing to do, stepping toward doing the Father's will. And I think that's one thing we can always get a sense of is what direction might be a little bit better than the one we've been going in. And sometimes that's just a small course correction, and sometimes that takes time. But if we persist in those kinds of prayers and in listening for an answer, remaining in silent receptivity, as you say, to either feel a response or to hear a response or to, you know, get an image or however that comes to us, you know, get some kind of subtle leading, then move in that direction and take the next right. Usually if we think about what would be the next right thing to do, usually we'll get some kind of idea regarding that.
Some thought comes to us.
Yeah. Or and
yeah,
you know, sometimes we ask for the answer to a prayer, and but then we already have a preconceived notion about how we want that answer to come. And
right.
And when we do that, oftentimes we miss the answer because we had already had a preset notion about how that prayer will be answered then or what our expectations are. But if we let go of expectations, in my experience at least, God surprises us and answers our prayer oftentimes in the place that we would least expect that answer to come from. Sometimes it's from a child. Many times it comes from a child or another person. Or, you know, an insight you get as you're out walking then. Or something you see that makes a correlation in your mind about something and it's like, oh, that's it. You know, so it's not this big dramatic thing where something drops on your head. It's oftentimes very subtle, and I find that that's the key to spiritual energies, really, to answers that come from the spiritual side of life. They're subtle. That's why they call it the still small voice. It's not yelling at you. You know, the Urantia book says in one place, the spirit never drives, only leads. It's a leading. It's leading you. It's not driving you, forcing you. It says in other places, it refuses. The agencies of God refuse to coerce us, refuse to, because the point is we come of our own free will. We find the answers we need. We look. God does not want us to be coerced into right action. He would rather we do the right thing because we love doing right.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's just interesting that we pray the things we pray for. And how, you know, and as you've pointed out, Joan, and of course, Jesus was a master of these things. And you, of course, would hold up for us, for all of us, the highest form of prayer.
And he made an example, too, I think, of another item in this section I mentioned, where that prayer for the sick and affected cannot, or afflicted, cannot take the place of loving and intelligent ministry to their necessities.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So that, you know, as was mentioned before, that we have to take what responsibility we possibly can in such situations along with our prayer.
Mm.
Yeah.
Good point.
You know, on the board, Dejo's making the point, you know, about, you know, if we pray to try to change someone else, like our neighbor who's offending us in some way, wouldn't we really be looking for the change to happen to us in the first place?
Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly right. And then the next thing is, you know, what about government officials, you know, who are not your neighbor, who you may have less contact with? What might that actually, you know, redound toward? And, well, again, you might not expect the prayer to have a direct effect, except that you might get in touch with your politician and start to talk to them about what it is you think they could be doing better. Not only that, you might also indicate to them, as is suggested, that one of the things that makes prayer efficacious for someone else, or praying for someone else efficacious, is to let them know that they're being prayed for.
Yes.
And that's a mighty changer of attitude in both people.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And to say, you know, I'm praying to maybe understand your point of view, rather than to say, I'm praying that you change your point. You know,
well, right.
I'm praying for you that you change, you know. No, I'm praying to understand the situation and to be more tolerant and accepting of it. And I really want to know your sentiments and your motives.
Exactly. So, you know, that this is, I just had, you know, this is a marvelous, you know, marvelously fruitful topic. And we have so much to learn about praying. The biggest thing we need to learn is that we can't pray too much. I mean, we don't have to necessarily always put ourselves in a room to pray. I think that it's good that we sequester ourselves for, you know, some portion of our day to pray, you know, whether it be, like some people advocate, to 20-minute periods or longer periods at one point. But I think the idea of prayer as a practicing of the presence of God, as is has been suggested by people like Frank Laubach and, you know, much earlier than that, Brother Lawrence, that some people might be familiar with. The idea, you bring into your awareness that you're in God's presence all the time, that you're never outside of God's presence, which I think as you become aware of, you know, just the magnitude of God and the love of God, you both become aware of God's presence in your life and are not disincentivized to not be aware, because you realize that God is loving and approachable. And so when you realize that and you live as though you're in the presence of God, which none of us does perfectly or all the time, you start to see everything that you're living a little bit differently.
Mm-hmm.
And you start to behave better when you realize that, if I really sincerely believe this, then I don't have the right to take certain actions that I might have taken in the past, you know, that would be counter to the best interests of, you know, my neighbor, my politician,
right,
people that I'm in relationship with.
Help me, Father, live up to my own high standards.
Yeah.
You know. Yeah. Help me be the person.
And help me live up to the higher ones that you have that you envision for me that I can't quite see yet.
Right.
That's a good prayer.
We have another caller on hold, and I'd like to put this caller on. Hang on here with us, Joan, if you like. Hold on.
Sure.
Area code 707, you're with us on the Cosmic Citizen.
Good morning, Paula. It's David Bush. How you doing?
Oh, good.
Hey, good morning, David.
Good morning, everyone.
I just thought
good
I would.
Morning.
Yeah, it's great to talk to you. I just thought I would. Well, you've kind of, from where I originally started, you guys have covered a lot of ground that I was thinking about. But I really was thinking about when we pray, how much of it is our active. How much is, I guess I'm thinking of the general theme of active versus passive, right? Uh-huh. And the thought of like something coming to us. And that is a gift, and we definitely know that it happens, but we also know that we are pushed to put that gift into action. And how much of prayer, I mean, you guys think of prayer as like a, is it a time to receive a gift, or is it a time to integrate? I guess it's probably a little bit of both, or all of that more, but I'm just kind of curious how everyone thinks about that aspect of it.
Yeah, I mean, the idea that prayer is regarded and spoken of directly in the book as a super psychologic process, you know, it certainly involves psychologic change in us just by taking the action of praying. And every time we do so sincerely, you know, God and the angels and everybody else are acting on whatever can be acted upon in our prayer. And it doesn't have, we're told, so much to do with the words. You know, the words are symbols for many things. But it might beg of us that we scrutinize our words a little bit better, only from the standpoint that, you know, what's really the underlying attitude that I have as I'm praying for that particular thing, especially when you may not be sure about what it is you're praying for. But when one is in the habit of praying for things that are a little more on the spiritual end, whether it be for spiritual wisdom, whether it be to know the Father's will, looking at what is it that is my attitude that's motivating this right now.
Gandhi talked about that. If your intentions are pure, then you don't really have to worry about making mistakes, because your mistakes, they'll take care of themselves. If your intentions are pure, you know, you can't really stumble too far. Yeah, that's interesting. Very interesting.
Well, and the whole of human race has evolved because of mistakes. I mean, it's absolutely, you know, it's a given to me that we will make mistakes, and that's how we learn. We learn by doing, and in the doing is the trial and error. You know, we obviously, I mean, every scientist has gone down the wrong, you know, road with a basic assumption about something that was wrong. And, you know, every religionist has made mistakes. Every human being, no matter what course they've chosen, has made mistakes. And really, I think then the prayer should be, God, help me make the most of my mistakes. Help me learn from my mistakes, the lessons you would have me learn, and not keep repeating the same mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
The idea of just owning our humanness, I think that's so important, because then we approach God as little children, and that's what Jesus meant when he said, unless you're teachable like a little child. You know, we approach the universe then as our big brothers and sisters that know way, way more than we do. And we understand our own limitations then, and then we open up for the lesson that our prayer is asking to be answered, you know? The gift, as you said, we open up to that gift that we are requesting. Give me this gift of insight. Give me this gift of knowledge that I'm lacking. Show me my blind side. You know, help me achieve what I can't seem to achieve, you know?
But it's probably through hard work that we're going to achieve it, right? I
mean, right.
No matter what. Isn't that always the kicker?
That's the kicker.
Yeah.
That's the kicker.
And
that's
once
okay.
we get that, though, once I think
yeah,
once we understand that, we're there.
We're in.
Yeah.
You know? Well, I'm excited. I'm on my way to Pato's spiritual
Wedding.
Gathering here in L.A. Well, today he's having
yeah.
a spiritual gathering, a Urantia Book gathering, family gathering, the Embassy Suites in L.A. I think he's got like about 300 people.
Well, isn't it his wedding day?
Well, his wedding day is tomorrow. So
oh, tomorrow, okay.
10 things today. But he's been putting together this spiritual gathering for months and months. He's doing it at the L.A. Embassy Suites. People started flying in on Wednesday. And then he incorporated his wedding, and then as only he could do, he's playing at the House of Blues tomorrow night after the wedding. So you got to love
great.
That. Although if anybody's around L.A. and around the House of Blues tomorrow night, it's going to be a fun show. So
I'm sure it will.
Well, and you know, you can always count on Pato to bring in spirit and meaning and value into every gathering that he does. You know, he's so sincere. Talk about somebody who prays sincerely. And after every concert, he comes down and does a prayer circle with whoever has been there listening. And celebrating with music and dance, and then Pato will come out afterwards and do a prayer circle and lead everybody in the most sincere prayer. And so it's really gratifying. Yeah. And I know my heart is with them in this happy time. Weddings are the happiest of times, and
absolutely.
Great to celebrate that with him. I'm glad you get to do that.
Yeah, I'm pretty happy about it, too. Thank you, Paula. We're all there, though, right? We're all in this together.
Yeah.
We know that.
We are.
Yeah.
And
absolutely.
That's, you know, and that's the answer to a prayer right there, that knowledge. That, you know, we come full circle sometimes, and, you know, we fight like family. But in the end, our brotherhood as human beings, our spiritual brotherhood is what matters most, more than any other factor. The love that we have for each other and the faith that we have in each other. You know, it's sometimes it's not a matter of faith in God. It's a matter of faith in humanity. Do we have faith? Because Jesus believed in us. Jesus put great trust in humankind. And, you know, I think when we can get to the point where we put great trust in each other, then... You know, we'll all fall short, but it doesn't matter. We're learning. We're growing. And prayer helps us do that, and that's the point, I think. You know, we've been talking about prayer, and one of the great things about prayer for me is to just go to the Father and unburden my heart. You know? Just let Him share in my sorrow, whatever it is, or my confusion or my doubt. Or my fear. And I give it to him as a mother. You probably know, all of you know what it's, you know, whether you were married to a woman or whether you are a woman, Joan, you know what it is to be afraid for your children. And I think fathers feel the same thing, or maybe not as keenly as mothers do. Mothers get kind of obsessed with it. And many times I have to say to Father, please take this from me. Take it from me. I don't want this fear. I want to have faith. All is well. And, you know, it's powerful. In the moment, he does take it. I give it to him, and he takes it. He takes it away. And sometimes I have to give it to him 10 times a day. And that's okay.
Well, we know mothers do all things better than fathers, first of all. I'd like to throw that out there.
I disagree. Are
you just trying to score points there, Dave? Come on.
No, I scored a point there. I didn't cry. I did.
Trust me on this.
Yeah. Well, you know, there is that aspect to what you're sharing that is covered in paper one on the Father, and that is, it is literally true. In all your afflictions, he is afflicted. In all your triumphs, he triumphs in and with you. His prepersonal divine spirit is a real part of you. And it goes on, the Universal Father realizes in the fullness of the divine consciousness all the individual experience of the progressive struggles of the expanding minds and the ascending spirits of every entity, being, and personality of the whole evolutionary creation of time and space. And all this is literally true, for in him we all live and move and have our being. And earlier it says, the progressive experience of every spirit being and every mortal creature throughout the universe of universes is a part of the Father's ever-expanding deity consciousness of the never-ending divine circle of ceaseless self-realization. So part of that sharing that we do of what we're going through with the Father, you know, it's one thing, he's sharing it with us as much as we're willing to share it with him, you know, just in terms of experience. But when we're conscious of sharing it with him, I think that's even more powerful, not just for us, but for the Father. There's mm-hmm. some aspect, it somehow adds to his divine circle of ceaseless self-realization. We can help the Father with that by actually sharing our afflictions, sharing our triumphs with the Father. Every time we share that with our thought adjuster is really becoming more through that process. And that may be part of that whole process. It's all a mystery, but clearly the Father wants it, and so we should do it.
Yeah, share the inner life. Yeah, there's a great quote that says that the will of God is nothing more nor less than your willingness to share the inner life with him.
Yes.
I love that. It's such a simple, succinct definition of what God's will is.
Yeah.
He wants you to share your inner life. Yeah.
Yeah, the exhibition of creature willingness to share the inner life with God.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, shall we read Evolving Prayer, and then we can probably, you know, discuss that a little bit, and that'll be it for this week, I think. But
well, it might be. Let's
are
Evolving
you going to read
prayer.
It, Andre? Hang on
I'll
here with us, callers, if
Dave
you like.
Wants to, you know,
well,
but
driving.
I'll be glad to. Well, he's driving. You
driving,
can't
Dave?
Read and drive, Dave?
Dave, are you driving? He may have put us on mute.
Yeah,
this
that's
is understandable
fine.
If he's driving.
Here we go. I drive with a book in my lap very often. No, I'm kidding. Don't do this at home, folks.
Paula.
Evolving.
Hello.
Prayer.
One last thing before you move on to evolving prayer. There was something that Andre said earlier that reminded me, and I'm not sure exactly where it is in the UB, but about the importance of praying for those who persecute us, you know, somebody we might perceive as an enemy, or I think Andre referred to this neighbor whose dog is invading your lawn, et cetera.
Uh-huh.
And the importance of praying earnestly for somebody that maybe we really don't like very much, or that we're sensing some bit of anger or resentment toward, that it's so important to pray for that particular person. And as I say, I'm not sure just where that's stated, but you might want to address that just a little bit more.
Well,
that's
something we're moving toward. Yeah, but go ahead, Paula.
Well, I was just going to say, Jesus said it too. He said, pray for those who despitefully use you. And there is a quote, Joan, and I, if you can find that would be great. I've been looking for that one recently, and I've had a hard time finding that one. But I think the gist of it is, if there's some mortal that troubles you, the best way to solve those issues is to pray for that person. You know, and sincerely pray for them. And I can't.
Uh-huh.
I've been having a hard time finding that quote. So if you find it, let me know. And you too, Andre, I mean, or anyone on the board.
I'm having trouble finding that one too.
Yeah, it's funny how that happens sometimes. You're looking for the right phrase, and obviously in a book with a million words, the word pray comes up a lot. and pray for them comes up as a phrase, but it's not the right one. So I've been looking for that one, Joan. So if you find it, let me know.
That's probably one of the most difficult of Jesus' admonitions to put into practice.
Oh, without a doubt. Without a doubt. And again, that's when you say to God, help me live up to these great teachings. Help me, help me honor this desire in my heart to be perfect like you are and to treat my fellows the way I know you would treat them. You know, it's certainly not easy. And prayer helps. But it still takes effort on your part then to remind yourself, wow, you know, am I doing the right thing here?
Yeah.
So, yeah.
That's how we grow.
That's how we grow. That's right.
Thank you.
Dave. You bet. So you're welcome to hang on here with us or, you know, and I'm going to read now section 2, Evolving Prayer.
Okay. The first prayers were merely verbalized wishes, the expression of sincere desires. Prayer next became a technique of achieving spirit cooperation. And then it attained to the higher function of assisting religion in the conservation of all worthwhile values. Both prayer and magic arose as a result of man's adjustive reactions to Urantian environment. But aside from this generalized relationship, they have little in common. Prayer has always indicated positive action by the praying ego. It has always been psychic and sometimes spiritual. Magic has usually signified an attempt to manipulate reality without affecting the ego of the manipulator, the practitioner of magic. Despite their independent origins, magic and prayer often have been interrelated in their later stages of development. Magic has sometimes ascended by goal elevation from formulas through rituals and incantations to the threshold of true prayer. Prayer has sometimes become so materialistic that it has degenerated into a pseudo-magical technique of avoiding the expenditure of that effort which is requisite for the solution of Urantian problems. When men learned that prayer could not coerce the gods, then it became more of a petition, favor-seeking. But the truest prayer is in reality a communion between man and his maker. The appearance of the sacrifice idea in any religion unfailingly detracts from the higher efficacy of true prayer in that men seek to substitute the offerings of material possessions for the offering of their own consecrated wills to the doing of the will of God. When religion is divested of a personal God, its prayers translate to the level of theology and philosophy. When the highest God concept of a religion is that of an impersonal deity, such as in pantheistic idealism, although affording the basis for certain forms of mystic communion, it proves fatal to the potency of true prayer, which always stands for man's communion with a personal and superior being. During the earlier times of racial evolution, and even at the present time in the day-by-day experience of the average mortal, prayer is very much a phenomenon of man's intercourse with his own subconscious. But there is also a domain of prayer wherein the intellectually alert and spiritually progressing individual attains more or less contact with the superconscious levels of the human mind, the domain of the indwelling thought adjuster. In addition, there is a definite spiritual phase of true prayer which concerns its reception and recognition by the spiritual forces of the universe, and which is entirely distinct from all human and intellectual association. Prayer contributes greatly to the development of the religious sentiment of an evolving human mind. It is a mighty influence working to prevent isolation of personality. Prayer represents one technique associated with the natural religions of racial evolution, which also forms a part of the experiential values of the higher religions of ethical excellence, the religions of revelation.
Again, as so often, it just says so much in one mm-hmm. section. Sean, do you have any thoughts about this?
Yeah, I've actually just been thinking about a point Andre made maybe 20 minutes ago, and it was just, I'm just going to read it very briefly, Andre. I think you'd read us a short passage that said, this progressive experience of every spirit being and every mortal creature throughout the universe of universes is a part of the Father's ever-expanding deity consciousness of the never-ending divine circle of ceaseless self-realization. So that line blew me away. I've just been thinking about that for the last 20 minutes. So there's a lot to take in, isn't there?
Oh, well, and Andre,
every section of the Urantia book you read, you can meditate on it for several hours, I think.
I know.
Right.
Everyone's in the universe of thought.
Yeah, you know, when we just reflect on that, you know, just a little bit, that, okay, here is the nature of God such that our Father, our loving Heavenly Father, though He is infinite, chooses to be influenceable, chooses to be responsive, chooses to actually be able to be affected by the tiny reality of one of His tiny, tiny children, that being us, one of quadrillions and quintillions and, you know, God knows how many, you know, children, you know, He has, and that have appeared on the worlds of space, to say the least, not to mention His angelic children and His children of the other orders of celestial beings. But when we think of the fact that every one of these beings, high and low, is important to God, that God is no respecter of persons, that somehow you praying to God and I praying to God are exactly the same and completely different at the same time, that there's no greater worth to your prayer or my prayer, and yet God responds to your prayer as though you were the only other being in existence, as though you were His only other son or His only other daughter. This is mystery in how that infinite loving God actually responds to us. And when we contemplate something like that, it can only work to our good in understanding that if God can truly love me that way, don't I have not so much the duty, but isn't it really behoove me to do my best to try and love everyone just a little bit better? And if I can't do everyone, just to do that one person at a time, you know, just that person who most irritates me. And I shared last week that there's a person at work that I've been praying for, and unfortunately it's one of those things that you know, something has come between us, and you know, if I don't do that, my attitude's just going to sour more and more and more. And as it turns out, things have been getting just a little bit better. I don't expect that, you know, any kind of major miracle is occurring between us or anything like that. But I need to continue to look at that person that way. Anyway, I don't want to distract from your point, Sean, because I think that's so important for us to realize that there's no distance that way. I mean, it may be very, very hard for us to keep progressing to the point, and it's going to take so long in our progression through the universe before we actually come, as it were, face to face with God. But in the meantime, God has put a fragment of himself right in us in order to bridge that gap now. And in order to experience what we're experiencing now, and literally, in order for a piece of him to become who we are and help us to become who he is. That's mind-blowing.
You know, and prayer helps us grow up spiritually. And as you were speaking, Andre, I was just thinking, and Sean, I think you'll appreciate this because you still have smaller children. You know, this concept from the section we just read that it says, well, when man learned that prayer could not coerce the gods, then it became more of a petition, favor-seeking. And what I see in my mind as a little child who, you know, they'll try just about everything to get their way. They'll, you know, they'll try everything to get your attention and get you to give them what they want. And first they may try, you know, whining and crying, and then they may try a full-out, full-blown temper tantrum.
A bit
and,
like us adults as well, really.
What, Sean?
A bit like us adults as well.
Yes, right. That's what occurred to me, is like, you know, here we are evolving in a way in mass as a humankind is not unlike a child. We evolve through very well set defined stages, and the small child will you know employ just about everything, anything to get you to give them what they want. But then they reach an age where they start to reason, and they maybe understand your reasoning why they can't have that, or they start to be able to accept the wisdom of the Father to say, well, you know, it's like Andre, you pointed out, Jesus at one point said, who among you would give a child a snake because you pulled it up in the nets and the child foolishly asked for it? You know, if you know how to give your children good things, how much more does the Heavenly Father know how to give his children what they need? And there's so much understanding of that as we mature as spiritual beings, as we mature spiritually, and it's a lot of what this whole paper is talking about, how humankind will mature spiritually and learn to ask a better question, learn to make a better prayer to God. You know, then we become full spiritual adults at some point. Not in this life probably, but, you know, subsequently, we really will have an understanding of the wisdom of God's, you know, parental guiding and the answer to our prayers. And there's another place that says, you know, the prayers that you say today may not be answered for 1,000 years, but they will be answered.
Yeah.
When you're ready to get that answer, it will be there.
Yeah, very much so, and it's hard to realize that at times, because very often our words indicate that you know, we're still praying for something immaturely, but that's a wonderful thing is that God and the celestial beings are busy proactively reinterpreting and translating our prayer into what perhaps our soul really would want,
mm-hmm.
and what our soul may really be asking for, but our mind can't get exactly to right away. Remarkable what this life is in some regards.
Well, and you know, they've reiterated now this theme throughout these three sections that we've read about this personal deity. And they've really kind of, they've tried to drive that point home. And they did in the second to the last paragraph, again, where they said, prayer contributes greatly to the development of the religious sentiment of an evolving human mind. It is a mighty influence working to prevent isolation of personality. This understanding that what you said, Andre, and you said it so beautifully, my prayer is heard, and your prayer is heard, and the prayer of the highest, mightiest being, their prayers are heard.
Yeah.
And they're acknowledged. And we're not operating in isolation here. We're not alone. We're together in this.
Yes, we are. I found that quote that Joan was looking for earlier.
Oh, yay. Where did you find it?
It's paper 100-4-4, and it has to do with, you know, if someone irritates you, you know, it starts with in physical life, the senses tell of the existence of things or whatever, but it goes on and it says, you can best discover values in your associates by discovering their motivation. If someone irritates you, causes feelings of resentment, you should sympathetically seek to discern his viewpoint, his reasons for such objectionable conduct. If once you understand your neighbor, you will become tolerant, and this tolerance will grow into friendship and ripen into love. Then it goes into our favorite vision. In the mind's eye, conjure up a picture of one of your primitive ancestors of cave-dwelling times, the wonderful caveman, you know, where you expand the frame. I won't go into that because we just did, you know, a few shows ago. But here then it goes on further. It says, you cannot truly love your fellows by a mere act of the will. Love is only born of thoroughgoing understanding of your neighbors, motives, and sentiments. It is not so important to love all men today as it is that each day you learn to love one more human being. If each day or each week you achieve an understanding of one more of your fellows, and if this is the limit of your ability, then you are certainly socializing and truly spiritualizing your personality. Love is infectious, and when human devotion is intelligent and wise, love is more catching than hate. But only genuine and unselfish love is truly contagious. If each mortal could become a focus of dynamic affection, this benign virus of love would soon pervade the sentimental emotion stream of humanity to such an extent that all civilization would be encompassed by love. And that would be the realization of the brotherhood of man.
I love that.
Mm-hmm.
This is such an amazing section. You know, and you had mentioned earlier, too, Andre, about, you know, this work relationship. And, you know, in my experience, of course, you know, the Urantia book tells us that it's in the family where we learn the invaluable lessons of patience, altruism, forbearance, you know, because you're there up close and real, and families don't hold back. Families pretty much tell each other what they think, and... But the other place
not much
where
candy
that happens,
coating in a family.
No,
yeah.
No candy coating at all in my experience. I mean, not much. You're right. And the other place where that happens is certainly in the work situation or people that you live in and are in close proximity to, your neighbors. You gave the example of the neighbor. And what came to mind for me is this example from Jesus in the shipyard. And I'd like to just read it quickly because it just came to my mind when you said that, and I love it. It's such a perfect example of how, you know, the solution is within us, typically.
Exactly. Go for it.
When Jesus, I'll start from the beginning. One of the young men who worked with Jesus one day on the steering paddle became much interested in the words which he dropped from hour to hour as they toiled in the shipyard. When Jesus intimated that the Father in heaven was interested in the welfare of his children on earth, this young Greek, Anaxand, said, "If the gods are interested in me, then why do they not remove the cruel and unjust foreman on this workshop?" He was startled when Jesus replied, "Since you know the ways of kindness and value justice, perhaps the gods have brought you this erring man near, perhaps the gods have brought this erring man near that you may lead him into this better way. Maybe you are the salt which is to make this brother more agreeable to all other men. That is, if you have not lost your savor. As it is, this man is your master in that his evil ways unfavorably influence you? Why not assert your mastery of evil by virtue of the power of goodness and thus become the master of all relations between the two of you? I predict that the good in you could overcome the evil in him if you gave it a fair and living chance. There is no adventure in the course of mortal existence more enthralling than to enjoy the exhilaration of becoming the material life partner with spiritual energy and divine truth in one of their triumphant struggles with error and evil. It is a marvelous and transforming experience to become the living channel of spiritual light to the mortal who sits in spiritual darkness. And he goes on. But again, you know, the answer is, if you are, perhaps the gods brought this man to you because you are the salt that is to restore his savor. And that's not, you know, again, that's not any easy thing, but it is an invaluable lesson.
It sure is.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's a perfect real-life example of what that previous quote is talking about. It's just, you know, how do you dynamically improve your relationships with others? We don't have the luxury, as we progress through the universe, of holding on to enemies. I mean, if that would make any sense. Can you imagine moving toward paradise with a constantly increasing bag of enemies as relationships? You know, where you say, no, I've written that person off. Don't need to have a relationship with that person. We're not in a position to judge what the value of a relationship ought to be. And so it's one of the areas where the province of prayer is most efficacious.
Yes, absolutely. Well, we are down to our last 3 minutes. So, Joan and Sean, would you like to throw in something here before we close? We'll be back next week with Section 3, Prayer and the Alter Ego. But, Sean, I'm so glad you came on and read with us today, and I hope you can come back.
Yeah, that was great fun. Thanks for having me. And I'm going to think very carefully about what we've talked about today, trying to think about it this week, the busy week. So you guys have a great week, and hopefully speak to you soon.
You're okay. One of the salt shakers of the British Isles, Sean.
You give your precious children a big hug for us.
And Paula, thanks again for that book, the Children's Your Answer book, because my daughter's loving it and asking me lots of questions about it, so thank you for sending it.
Oh, I'm so glad. Marvelous. Happy to do it, John. So glad. God bless.
Take care, guys. See you soon.
Okay.
See you.
Bye.
God bless.
Paula, I just looked up that prayer reference to prayer for those who curse and persecute us as 146. Section 2, paragraph 11, and that's not correct, because that's the section I had referred to earlier, and that's not the one that talks about who curse and persecute us.
Right, right.
So that is actually an error in the index.
Oh, okay.
So we'll have to keep looking for that one.
We'll keep looking for it. As I recall, it says something to the effect of the best way to you know, to affect a change in that relationship is to pray for that person every day. And I've been looking for it for a while. I can't find it. So any help you guys can give me is great. I appreciate it.
Yeah, that other one, right?
Yeah, right. And thanks, Joan, for tuning in with us. It was great to have you on the show. And give your beautiful daughter, Crystal, a big hug from me.
Will do. Sorry she didn't feel well enough to join in today.
Well,
thank you.
We always do.
Yeah.
You're welcome. Thank you, sweetie.
Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
Bye, Joan.
And Andre
and
James.
Yeah, thank you, Paula. What a wonderful show. You know, being kept mindful of prayer all day, I think that's going to take us through the week. And, I think we've given birth to another series here, haven't we?
Yeah. Yes, and it'll be wonderful to explore this with our listeners and with you. You know, and we invite you to come back next week and let's keep talking about prayer and give us a call and let's talk about, you know, your ideas about prayer and what you think. We'd love to hear from you. And until then, we'll just say bye for now.
Yeah. Bye for now, everyone. See you next week.
Bye for now.
You've been listening to The Cosmic Citizen, a radio program focused primarily on the study and discussion of the Urantia Book and its teachings. The Urantia Book is a religious text that claims to be written by angels and other superhuman personalities. If you are a Urantia Book reader or a spiritual seeker looking for new truth, we hope and pray you have been nourished and edified by our ministry. Please remember that the views expressed on this program do not reflect the official views and opinions of any Urantia organizations. There is no official interpretation of the Urantia Book. So all opinions expressed on this program exclusively reflect the personal biases of the hosts, guests, and callers who participate in these discussions. And remember, only a brave person is willing honestly to admit and fearlessly to face what a sincere and logical mind discovers.